Staging Sound, a podcast reflecting on theatre music, sound design, sonic practices and experiences. Welcome to Staging Sound and yet another episode on all things to do with sound and music and theatre and stage and technology and so forth. We have reached day three or session four of a conference that I'm documenting through this podcast, which happened in September 2023 in Munich, and it was entitled Theatre Sound as Collaboration. And it was very much a joint effort between myself and the group of research fellows who were working and collaborating with me over the course of a year, supported by the Center for Advanced Studies here at the LMU in Munich. Now, this last session, this last day of the conference went back into history. It was entitled Sound in Revisited Theatre Stagings. The whole panel, the whole session was curated by Anna Bozinska, Ursula Kramer and Julia Schröder. And Julia Schröder will introduce you to this first part of the three podcasts which will document this fourth session. Enjoy this episode.
So, good morning to a very early session today. I'm very happy to see you all online and in the room. This will be the last session of this wonderful conference, and it's the historical perspective. Those of us who work historically and ask ourselves what to do with sound in theatre that is past. And we curated this session, Anna Bozinska next to me, Ursula Kramer online, and myself. My name is Julia Schröder. If you look at a current German theatre's productions list, you will see some new and many canonical plays being performed. They are based on a written play, newly interpreted, newly staged. Part of these stagings is sound. That means music, sound design, noises off, not to mention, of course, as we did yesterday, the voices of the actors, the speech being produced as part of the interpretation. The sound is ephemeral. It is fleeting. It exists when it is produced, performed, and then it's gone. What evidence do we have of past theatre stagings? As we will discuss, we often have textual sources, less often notations. Philological research needs to be done to find, decipher, contextualize these sources. In the panel discussion, Professor Dr. Ursula Kramer will speak on her research on theatre music from the 18th to the 20th century. Furthermore, we have objects like instruments and sound recordings, which are kept in archives and museums. The director of the Theater Museum in Munich, Dr. Dorothea Volz, told me that they recently acquired a record collection. That would be an example. She will take part in the panel discussion for the museum's perspective. Other examples include historically informed performance practice. We have that in music, we have that in theater, of course. Reconstructions, I know them mainly from dance. We have the possibility of modeling, that is in architecture and in virtual reality. And I hope we will welcome Dr. Andrea Walle in the panel discussion, who will be here to discuss the possibilities of the virtual reality remodeling of multimodal art, let's say. And we will discuss the possibilities for theatre performances, past theatre performances, and the sound, the spatialized sound in that with these new technologies. Online, we can find digital exhibitions, which publicize research in historical theater events. I just took this as an example where we can see on the picture a model of an historical theater and the music performed for this theatrical event was played and recorded and is part of this retelling of historians of a performance in this case in 1589, which would be one example. Of course, you all know from theater historically informed performance practice. In this case, in the reconstruction of Shakespeare's Globe Theatre in London, and from performing in there, many things have been found out about music, for example, because in an open-air building like this, in this very specific theater acoustics, other instruments were be able to help the performance, and there has been much knowledge acquired in just playing in this rebuilt theater. Then I brought an example from a reconstruction of a choreography. This one is very famous. It's Nijinsky's choreography of Le Sacre du Printemps with, of course, Igor Stravinsky's music. And I think this historical reconstruction of the choreography and the costumes and the stage design didn't hinder new choreographies being made on that music. In fact, it is maybe the score which is most often choreographed. So it is not a hindrance if we reconstruct the historical, let's say original choreography in this case. It is just an addition, I would say. And of course we know more reconstructions of sound installations. Here is an example of David Tudor's posthumously reconstructed, or in this case the artists speak of an evolution, not a reconstruction, of the artwork, which has been newly realized and sold to museums. In this case, we see a picture from the MoMA in New York. Professor Peter Kiefer, who is a sound artist himself, will be our expert on exhibiting sound in the panel. He will not only take the side of newly made sound art, but also of the auditory scenography that is having a soundscape for a museum's exhibition. Problems we can talk about, or in our field, seem to be access, that is copyright issues, digital obsolescence, a materialized culture that object-based collections bring about. And, of course, the discourse on authenticity, what is the true interpretation. We will find more problems, I hope so. And lastly, one of my students asked last semester, why reconstruction? And I'm sure many of you asked the question as well. And with our plant moderator, Irene Lehmann, I collected some points, but unfortunately she fell ill. But we are very, very lucky to have my esteemed colleague Anna Ricke here, and she will take the part of the moderator today in the panel discussion. So let's just have a look at my points or our points, and please think about further. So that would be situating the music in a staging. It is always part of a whole, of a performance, right? But there is, of course, a historical interest. I mean, studying theater studies, studying musicology, you will always be told about great performances. And then you will ask yourself, yeah, but how did they sound? What was it actually? And you only have these bits and parts and maybe a picture, maybe a sound snippet. And somehow you try to imagine what it was. So there is a historical interest. And it forms the canon we're talking about, a kind of cultural identity, also to place things in a historical narrative, let's say. It's a collective development. It's also for young artists, or even not so young artists, learning from past problems and solutions. And I hope we will find more points to be filled in the discussion. Now I'm very much looking forward to Anna Buczynska's lecture. I'm just going to introduce her very briefly. Anna Buczynska is a professor in drama and theater at the
Jagiellonian University
in Krakow. Although coming from literary studies, she has worked a lot on music and theater, and I just want to point out that her latest book, Atlas Anatomica, I'm trying a translation here about Georg Büchner, which came out last year, just won a prize, and we hope very much that it will be translated into English soon so we can read it. Anna will provide the examples that I didn't really provide, and I'm very much looking forward to her lecture on the great theater maker Tadeusz Kantor's sound objects and sound in his theater productions. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you so much. Like most of us, I am this kind of octopus person. Someone here used this term in June when we met for the first time. And one of my activities, one of my tentacles, is working as a curator for a center of Tadeusz Kantor's art, Krikoteka, in Krakow. Krikoteka is basically an archive of his work, started by him. What is really interesting, he already started, you know, collecting objects for his future museum, future archive, but also an exhibiting space for lectures, performances, workshops, and so on and so on. And as you can guess, there are like dozens of Tadeusz Kantor's exhibitions organized each year in Poland, abroad. So we really have to choose the objects and really put them into one context or another, and thousands of papers published, so you really have to think about new perspectives, new ideas, and it's really hard to say something new about Kantor, but I think one of the areas of his work that are still not very well researched is this sonic dimension of his work, not exactly music, because there are some really good papers, really good texts on his music and how he used different compositions in a very contemporary way and so on, but sound of Tadeusz Kantor's theater is something not researched yet. So right now I believe that one of the most promising perspectives of researching Kantor's work, and especially the way he shows us history and memory, is the new materialism. Because recognizing the agency of things, rather than reducing them to reflections of social changes, permits us to perceive an entirely different dimension of history. The objects gain particular importance in times of crisis of representation, which both world wars and their immediate aftermaths, times of political upheaval and systemic change, undeniably were. In peacetime, things are associated with a specific constant function. They have let's say, instructions for use. Their meaning, also in its symbolic dimension, is stable and defined. As such, they act more as stabilizing element in the social order than as a questioning factor. But turbulent periods in history prompt not only revaluation of human ontology, but also an undermining of the traditional ontology of objects. Above all, however, they alter, often fundamentally and irreversibly, the mutual relations of the two. Andrew M. Jones and Nicole Boivin, in their text on the agency of objects, propound, in their development of the economic thesis of Karl Marx, the thesis that things and machines and technologies in particular change the course of history, speeding it up and altering the human lifestyle. Another scholar, Jane Bennett, stresses that people do not appreciate, quote, these material powers which can aid or destroy, enrich or disable, enable or degrade us, in any case call for our attentiveness or even respect. And in the post-traumatic theater and happenings of Tadeusz Kantor, things retain or regain their subjectivity. They become objects that cannot be controlled. They demonstrate various temperaments. In her classic article on Kantor's machines, not necessarily sound machines, all of them, first published in 1985, Brunella Eruli wrote, quote, objects, actors, wood, old papers, or human bodies, everything functions on the same plane. The privileges that humans award themselves in the world are a function of deceit, of pitiful tricks, of sleight of hand, unquote. So in the theater of Tadeusz Kantor, things retain their subjectivity, often taking on the role of so-called malicious props, like in slapstick comedies. Which seem to lead a life of their own, behaving in a way that is impossible for either the stage characters or the audience to predict. And what does it have to do with sound? In one of his most important manifestos, Kantor writes about the contrast being a crucial tool in his work, in his performances. Quote, the network of relationships between the forms is built by contrast and conflicts. It is the contrast, unable to coexist peacefully and brought together by force, which create new values and the totality indispensable for the existence of the work of art. In theater, this totality is achieved via the process of balancing the contrasts between diverse scenic elements, such as motion and sound, visual forms and motion, space and voice, word and motion of forms, etc. As far as the cognitive aspect of theater is concerned, this contrast must have sharp edges, comma, surprise, shock, and lead to the creation of tension between two separate and incompatible realities or objects. So, for example, Kantor really liked to play with this contrast and tension between what we see and what we hear. For example, he really likes to play with music instruments on stage, but most of his music instruments do not function the way we think they should function. So, for example, there is a number of silent instruments in his performances. Just two examples, because there are many of them. In one of his first performances, produced in underground theater during the Second World War, The Return of Odysseus, you have, for example, people playing some ancient instruments, but in fact they are completely silent. What is also interesting, this performance had to be like very, very silent because it was forbidden in Krakow to perform officially. So in fact, it was a matter of life and death. It's not a metaphor, unfortunately, to really keep everything silent and perform in a private flat. So nobody, recognizes there is like illegal Polish theater going on. Another example, Where Are the Snows of Yesteryear, from 1979, one of my favorite objects or Kantor machines, so-called the Trumpet of the Last Judgment. So, of course, when we think about the Trumpet of the Last Judgment, its sound is able, to make the people rise from the dead and attend the Last Judgment. We are thinking about something extremely loud. And again, it is silent, and it is somehow silenced. It's also a very important topic in a cantor's art, being not able to produce sound, being not able to speak, being banned from this community of sound. On the other hand, there are some instruments, objects that do not produce sounds. They are also mute or silent, but you can hear some sounds that are borrowed or stolen. Like in Wielopole, you have a person who plays hurdy-gurdy, but what we see and what we hear is like two completely different things, because the music that comes out of this hurdy-gurdy instrument is a completely different piece of music. Also, in I Shall Never Return, you have soldiers that are also playing violas. And again, the sound that comes out of their violas is not exactly the viola sound. It's a kind of very threatening sound, because you have this tension between them being soldiers, like very dangerous in this setting, and music they play. By the way, there is also a very important connection between what they does and this topic of music in concentration camps, but I have no time to really go into this direction, because this is also like topic, you know, that is under the surface of Cantor's work. But what I found the most interesting in this frame of our conference are the objects that produce sounds, and that produce sounds that are like really, really loud. I'm going to show you one of them. It is so-called annihilation machine, a very, very rare clip of this machine operating, because it was used in performances from early 1960s, so there are no videos of it, unfortunately. And so basically, it's an instrument of sonic torture, and Cantor really unleashes its material powers. And in order to achieve actors' autonomy in this performance, Cantor used this huge construction made of folding chairs. And when the machine was operating, its robot-like movements and really annoying sounds destroyed any possibility of executing dramatic action on stage. In reality, it's much, much louder, I have to say. The actors trying to avoid the machine were pushed aside, had to fight for the action space and struggle not to be thrown off the stage. They really had to shout, they really had to try to, you know, fight with this machine for their autonomy on stage. So the presentation of the text was thus dismembered by the actions of the machine and the actors. And Cantor writes about this annihilation machine, a small excerpt from one of his manifestos. A small platform is the stage. Almost all of it is taken up by a huge pile of folding chairs, which look alike, faded, beaten by rain and time, seated out, folded and arranged as in a storage room, functionless, linked together with rusty wires, ropes that is put into motion. Its movement acquires psychological characteristic. It is sudden, furious, nervous, bouncing up and down, interrupted, dying out, jittery, ridiculous, monotonous, ominous. The sound is blunt, dry, clattery, repetitive. By the way, if you read Cantor's manifestos, you can find a really rich vocabulary of sound descriptions. He was really great in it. I mean, he really used the possibilities of Polish language very well, and really tried to translate it into words. Another object, well, the list is very long, but I just want to show you two of them. So another object is the mechanical cradle, performing in probably the most famous Cantor's performance, The Dead Class.
Let's go.
is not like the original setting. This is the like film version made by Andrzej Wajda, so it's a little bit different from the performance. But this scene is in the performance, of course. You can see this cleaning woman who is also like a metaphor of death at the same time, with this mechanical cradle. Inside the cradle there are two wooden balls, no baby, but two wooden balls that create this kind of noise. And if you think about this tension between lullaby that have to be very soothing and silent and nice and gentle, and this terrible sound of those wooden balls in this empty cradle. Of course, this is this kind of metaphor, sonic metaphor that Cantor really likes to use, and he describes it in a way: a symbol of death is a symbol of life. A cradle is a coffin. Instead of a newborn baby, two wooden dead balls are used. Instead of the child's whining, the dry rattle of the balls is heard. So all of the Cantor's objects are being displayed either in his museum Krikoteka, either during various exhibitions around the world. So they are extracted from their original context and reintroduced in another setting, decontextualized, re-inscribed in another place or a narrative. So they become still, motionless, quiet, harmless as well. This is what is very important for me, that they become harmless, and during performances they were really like active, dangerous, they had agency, they were threatening, they were really like autonomous performers, not on the same level people were. And they are still motionless, quiet, they are distanced from visitors, people cannot directly physically engage with the things on display. Sometimes there are monitors and headphones so that the visitors have a chance to watch performance snippets showcasing the noise machines in action, but not always. And it makes these objects lose their materiality and interactivity even more, because you have like object on one side and video on other side, so there is no materiality in it. Why they're exposed like that? Is it only for the sake of visitors' comfort? They could be stored in separate rooms with, for example, warnings telling the visitors it's going to be loud. Or is it a matter of trying not to destroy the now historical object? But most of them are not the originals used on stage anyway. Cantor kept reconstructing his object, and the ones that are in his archive are not the ones that were performing in his productions. Many of them were made like in 1980s. Also this annihilation machine, it's not the original one that performed on stage, but Cantor like rebuilt it after a very long time. To be honest, I didn't find many good solutions how to solve this situation. I tried to look for some ideas how to exhibit them. I found some interesting ideas in, quite surprisingly, ethnographic and anthropological papers, especially the ones devoted to exhibits of objects that are at the same time material and immaterial. For example, certain Native Americans and First Nations communities' artifacts that are claimed to possess agency, to be in fact alive. So, for example, there is a very interesting article, I just give you a source, by Noemi Etienne, When Things Do Talk in Storage, Materiality and Agency Between Contact and Conflict Zones. She writes that this Western obsession for the insurance of an object's physical immortality, including its removal from the contamination of human association, is totally counter to the Native American orientation of, let's quote it, use it or lose it. The opposition between two cultures and two visions, one obsessed with the use of objects and the other one fascinated by their preservation, might seem simplistic, but in fact it really makes us think about our approach to the objects. And in fact, Native people often accuse curators of destroying their artifacts by preventing their use, because they think that putting them in, you know, like glass boxes really kills them. You have to use those objects to keep them alive, and putting them in glass boxes, it's like putting people in glass objects. And I think that maybe it's the same with theater props and machines. One of the very interesting examples of how to combine these two approaches, Western and non-Western one, is permanent exhibition of in National Museum of Australia. They have recently attempted to facilitate precisely these kinds of bodily, multisensory and emotional, as well as purely cognitive interactions with the objects they chose for an exhibition. Their strategy involves dividing the exhibition into 40 smaller exhibits and centering each of those on one key object with a number of other objects, leading off from it in order to evoke different strands of the stories concerned, encouraging visitors to concentrate primarily on objects and the relationship between them. They also installed sensory stations to occupy each exhibit, trying to facilitate not just superficial exploration of object, but more lasting, imaginative and emphatic engagement through the stimulation of the bodily senses. Visitors can, for example, smell sea cucumbers when looking at cauldrons used by Indonesian fishermen, or trace with their finger the stitches on an embroidered map that is a copy of the original displaced adjacent to it. So they really, you know, promote this kind of active two-way engagement between people and things, especially when they used to be like very practical. And last, the very, very last example, very last idea. Maybe we shouldn't be so obsessed with displaying the original things at all. Last year I had the chance to be in Dublin and I went to see the exhibition about the life and work of the Nobel awarded poet Seamus Heaney. And one of the objects that was exhibited there was a so-called rain stick, because he got it as a present at one point. This is a kind of instrument, you turn it and it really sounds like rain falling, because there are like dry seeds inside of it. And he wrote a very famous poem about it. And a copy of it was a part of the exhibition. So you can probably see it on the right. There is a caption like, "Would you like to hear the sound of rain? Turn the rain stick slowly." And everyone was like turning this rain stick slowly and listening to it. And it was very effective, because suddenly his way of thinking and working became, you know, very present in this museum space. So this was like a very, it really made a strong impression on me. And by the way, I didn't tell you the title of this exhibition, and the title of this exhibition was "Listen Now Again." So yes, thank you. That's it.
Wonderful, Anna. Really, thank you so much for not only providing us with a direct transition into the discussion, but before we invite our online panelists to unmute them, I want us to have the chance to ask you directly about your wonderful examples of Tadeusz Kantor's machines. We're running a bit late. So are there some questions that we cannot move into the panel discussion, which is following immediately? No. So because Anna will stay on the panel, oh, there is.
Just about to formulate something.
Adrian.
Thanks so much, Anna. That was really, really interesting and exciting, because I feel like I've read about Kantor a lot, but not been able to access even videos of the production. So it's always a bit hypothetical to me. So it was really interesting to see some examples of the instruments he made. I'm so taken with the Annihilation Machine, just as a concept. And thank you for sharing the clip of it. But I have to say, I did find it a little bit underwhelming. I was reminded of, I think we talked about this, Julia, about I went to listen to the recording of the music used for Artaud's production of the Cenci, and was similarly disappointed to hear the recording of the music that was supposed to be so affective in performance.
I couldn't make it this way, but it was extremely loud, and Cantor really liked, you know, to torture his actors and his audience. In early 60s, he was very much into happenings and this kind of performances. So yes, it's extremely loud. Sorry, I couldn't, you know, give you the impression of it. But it's really like you are in the middle of a construction site, and you know all the people, you know, just, you know, make this very, very unpleasant, very threatening noise. And also because it's 5 meters high, you also had this feeling that it's going to collapse, like every moment it can collapse on you. And so the stage was very crowded with actors, and they really had, you know, to be always trying to avoid this machine, the noise, but also those moving for the chairs.
I'm wondering how one goes about making the power or the life or the impact of these instruments apparent outside the context of the theatre production of which they were originally part. Because there we understand them to have a certain efficacy, and we take them out of that context. Is that inevitably lost? Or is there something that one can do curatorially to try to make them have that lost power?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, such a good question. I think in many cases, this the tension, this affective power comes from juxtaposing music he used with this sound of the objects. For example, I think one of Cantor's performances that really aged very well, I would say it still, you know, makes a very lasting impression on everyone who starts to study it, is one of his really small performances he did in Italy. It was based on Maurice Maeterlinck play about Tintagiles. And in fact, it's the only performance he did after the Second World War with music that was composed and not, you know, found music, not a kind of soundtrack of different songs. He asked the Italian composer Saro Cosentino to write music for him. So we have this, in fact, quite simple music going on from loudspeakers, and also a kind of machine on stage that produces different sounds in a very material way. You have all of those crackling sounds of wood and old wheels, steel wheels that are like behind it. And I would say this contrast between the music that sounds a little bit old-fashioned right now, and exactly as you said, could be a little bit disappointing, like from, you know, melodramatic movie or something like that, combined with this like original sounds of those objects that are in a museum in Sicily right now, it really makes a like lasting impression, because you have this in this performance. You have a tension between what is basically it's also about life and death, but it's also about, it's very self-reflective in a way that Cantor combines his two aesthetic influences. One is symbolic art of turn of 20th century, but the other one is like Bauhaus and all those kind of, you know, like being into a construction and thinking about materiality. So in this case, they usually display this stage design for it. They keep it moving. It's not very loud, but still you can hear how it operates. And then they play music from loudspeakers. And there's also a recording of the whole performance made for Italian TV. So yes, in this case, it really works. In some other ones, I also have to say, being a Cantor scholar, I have to admit that sometimes I'm like, should I show my students those performances, or should they, you know, just read the reviews and not get disappointed because of it like having this, you know, dated feel maybe a little. But yes, I think this Tintagiles performance really really made me think about this new materiality thing, because in its case, it's so obvious that what is still alive, it's the objects, it's his stage design, and not necessarily the actors you can watch on videos and the way they acted, but the stage design, really Bauhaus-like, with some huge puppets, a little bit like Oskar Schlemmer works. It works very well, also because it is so alive because of those material sonic quality of it.